I'm starting this recording.
For myself,
on
last call after Mr.
July 24th. On the morning of July 24th, the Supreme Court, 8-0, ordered the president to surrender the tapes. The vice president heard about this shortly after the court decision was made public and decided that he wouldn't say anything as far as the press was concerned until or unless the president made some sort of response. So we had quite a problem in fending off the press inquiries, which were coming in at a great rate. The complicating factor was that CBS that day had chosen and been given the chance to follow the vice president wherever he went, photograph him, do a day in the life of the vice president. And Phil Jones and the CBS crew were following him wherever he went. At the time the court decision came through, the vice president was in his office. Luckily, the CBS crew was at the Capitol awaiting the vice president's arrival at his Capitol office. Just before the decision came out, a problem had arisen in that Dean Birch wanted to talk to the vice president. But with the CBS crew around, the chief of staff, Bob Hartman, didn't want the CBS crew to know that Birch was going in to see the vice president. And so I was given the job of getting the CBS crew out of the way before Birch arrived. And luckily, I was able to do it without any serious problems involved, because they wanted to get over to the Capitol to catch the vice president as he came in, and had filmed the vice president in his office just before Birch was to arrive. So we got the crew out and left without anyone knowing that Birch came in to see the vice president. And a similar problem arose on the Hill, where the first meeting the vice president had was with the minority leader John Rhodes and Mel Laird and Al Quie, presumably to discuss impeachment, although I don't really know what the meeting was about, but Rhodes wanted to be kept very secret. Well, as it turned out, the vice president had told Jones that meeting was to take place and persuaded Phil not to film the meeting, but Phil knew that the meeting had taken place. And all I could do was say, well, I don't know anything about it, which I didn't, and couldn't even confirm who was there, because I didn't know, which I didn't, except it was in Rhodes' office, and let it go with that. When the vice president got over to the Capitol and had his meeting with Rhodes and came back, I went up into the gallery, the Senate Radio TV gallery, to get Jones to tell him that the vice president was on his way back. And I was immediately hit by everybody in the gallery for a film with the vice president, and had to stave off their demands because the vice president said he didn't want to say anything. When we got through with the filming in the Capitol, the vice president then went to a luncheon with the Washington Post editors and Catherine Graham and all the top Washington Post people. Luckily, that was designated as off the record before it began, so there was no problem with that as far as the Supreme Court decision was concerned. And during the afternoon, we had more and more inquiries from the press, but no real problems in in staving them off. Just before the vice president went to his home that evening, he got a call from Al Haig telling him what the president was going to, or what the attorney for the president, James St. Clair, was going to say in response to the Supreme Court decision. And when he got back to his residence, CBS wanted to do a little piece on his reaction to the announcement that the president was going to surrender the 64 tapes subpoenaed. And so Paul wrote the statement and called ABC and NBC and had them go out there too. The only problem was that he forgot to tell me that he was issuing the statement. So I had a couple of calls at home before I knew the statement was issued, and it was a little embarrassing, and I called Paul, and we had a small go-round on that. But the day ended with that development, at which point the House Judiciary Committee was in the process of starting its hearings on the impeachment, public hearings with full television and radio broadcasts. And so I stayed up quite late to see what was happening in those hearings. During the day, one interesting thing happened when I was in Bob Hartman's office. We were talking about the various developments of the day, and Hartman said, well, it looks to me now as though it's just a question of time. And meaning time before Vice President Ford became president, and insisted that we get as many newsmen on the plane going out to Muncie, Indiana the next day as we could, which meant we had to bump three Secret Service men in order to get four additional newsmen on the plane, which we did. And from now on, the policy is that we'll take a minimum of Secret Service and a maximum of newsmen. To me, that was as significant as anything else that happened during the day. In the contacts I had with the vice president all day, we never discussed the subject at all, except in relation to the problem that newsmen might ask questions. And he said, the only thing he said was, I don't want to comment in any way on this, and repeated it very firmly until he had word as to what the White House was going to do. One interesting thing happened during the afternoon. The vice president went up to talk to a group of future farmers of America, and we laid down a rule at the beginning: there would be no questions after his appearance, which ordinarily he takes questions, and in light of the circumstances, we decided there'd be no questions, and the vice president was very insistent that there be no questions. However, when he went up, he told Paul Milich on the way to the meeting that he wasn't sure what he'd say, but he got before the group, and a little 10-minute speech made a very appealing, I thought, speech to the group concerning the necessity for faith in the United States, and explained why he thought anyone should have faith in the United States, and did it on the basis of what other countries thought about the United States and why they held the United States in such high regard, as demonstrated in various things, including the reliance on the United States in the Middle East crisis and in the Cyprus crisis. And it was, I thought, very effective. And in all that, no mention of what was going on. The vice president never mentioned Mr. Nixon by name, but did talk about the President of the United States and his efforts, but never mentioned Mr. Nixon by name. The mention by Hartman that it's just a question of time is the first time in the nearly 8 months I've been on the staff that I've heard anybody say anything, indirectly or directly, that would indicate there's any thought about a change taking place. First time. And this is the report for Thursday, July 25. Rather quiet day in the office. The vice president left in the middle of the afternoon to go on his three-day swing to Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio. We didn't have many phone calls today, surprisingly. I forgot to mention yesterday that at the end of the day, Walter Moat, who's in charge of the Capitol Hill office, called to inquire as to what we'd heard about the vice president or the president, said there were all kinds of wild rumors floating around on Capitol Hill, which is typical of Capitol Hill in that sort of a situation. But was surprised, really, that we hadn't had more phone calls or more rumors than we had, and we hadn't had many. But he said all kinds of stories were going around over there. Today we got very little. The only sort of stories we got were one from a newspaper in New York, which had heard or manufactured a report that the vice president had offered one of the members of the House Judiciary Committee, who's retiring, a Republican by the name of Smith, a job on his staff. And I approached Mr. Hartman and the vice president, and neither of them said they'd heard anything about it, so we denied the story. But it spread from the New York newspaper, the little newspaper in Tonawanda, New York, to the two Buffalo papers, the Gannett papers, and the implication being that the position on the staff had been offered Mr. Smith in order to purchase a favorable vote against impeachment. I also had a call from the Congressional Quarterly with great speculation as to what the vice president was going to do to uphold the president in lobbying against an impeachment vote, and I simply went to great lengths to explain that the vice president was not going to lobby, he was not going to seek out people, that he would talk to people if they came to him, but he was not going to make an active or play an active role. The Congressional Quarterly didn't exactly believe that, from the way the reporter kept pushing questions at me, but I tried my best to convince him, never really did succeed, I don't think. Outside of that, very little in action. The vice president was busy most of the day in ceremonial duties, greeting various people. I sat in on one of the ceremonial deals where he greeted a 19-year-old black kid from Riverside, California, who was named in either the or one of the outstanding teenagers in America for the year, and who was a Democrat. And it was rather interesting. The vice president was very good in this one-to-one conversation, and encouraged the young guy to speak out, and the young guy was pretty gentle for a Democrat, and after it was all over, exclaimed in considerable surprise as to what a nice guy the vice president was. And it struck me that it's too bad the vice president can't sit down and talk with everybody in a one-on-one or a in a small group situation, because that's where he's at his best. So very warm, and very friendly, and very interested in other people. And he really comes through beautifully in a situation like that. Well, the newsman who called during the day was Bill McGaffin of the Daily News, wanting to know where the room that the vice president maintains on the House side was located, so that he could look at it and see where the vice president was going to do his lobbying with members of the House. So I told him there won't be any lobbying, and said I'd have to check on where the room was, because I honestly didn't know exactly where it was myself. Talked to Bob Hartman, who talked to the vice president, and then called McGaffin himself and told him where the room was. Also told him that it wasn't going to be used for lobbying, and that if McGaffin wanted to take a look at it, we'd be glad to show it to him. But we'll see what McGaffin puts into the Daily News. One other piece came out today in the Chicago Tribune about the staff. We've had a lot of articles in the past couple of weeks about the staff, most of them uncomplimentary. And this one was not very kindly to Paul Miltich. It was by a guy in the Chicago Tribune who said that there had been some unfavorable articles about the staff, and named particularly Miltich, and said that he rated a C-minus as far as the press on the plane that went to Grand Rapids was concerned. And this disturbed Paul considerably, but I don't think it really bothers him too much, because the vice president has told him that he thinks that Paul's doing a good job, and that's the big thing. And Paul's right in thinking that. And so we'll see how many other articles will be coming out in the near future. It was a quiet day at the office today, except for phone calls complaining about the vice president's statement in Indiana the previous evening, in which he said he believed from the bottom of his heart in the vice president's complete innocence. This caused some consternation among some of the staff members, including myself, Jack Marsh, Milt Friedman, and others, who could not quite understand why the vice president had gone much farther in his defense of the president, made it much stronger than he had before. We had somewhere around 20 phone calls complaining about the vice president's statement, and three which defended him. Not really much of a representative indication, but it's the first time in several weeks that we've had any phone calls at all, of which I've been aware, regarding the vice president's statements. It'll be interesting to find out where and how and why the vice president decided to say what he did say at the time he said it. I did spend about an hour this afternoon watching the House committee hearings, and was impressed greatly with the demonstrated ability, knowledge, and articulate expression of views of the members of the committee. It was very obvious they'd done their homework extremely well and were arguing their various points with considerable knowledge, compared to what the Senate committee does. It seems to me that the House has demonstrated once again what anyone who's covered Congress realizes very quickly, that it really is the House side that does its homework, knows what's going on, and is able to formulate ideas, legislation, and in this case, impeachment charges and arguments against impeachment far better than the Senate, which does not have time, the individual senators do not have time to prepare their arguments. This is, represents a tremendous amount of work on the part of the members of the committee. Each one, each member of the committee of 38 seems to have an extremely good grasp of what's going on and of the information involved. Very impressive thing to watch. Well, this was the day where the thing that everyone had expected, but I hadn't really, actually did happen. I had been called back from vacation, left Wednesday afternoon, got back last night with everybody assuming that resignation was at hand, but no serious indication. And at the office in the early morning hours from 8 o'clock on, we were saying that the end meeting at that the vice president still intended to take his trip to California, an 11 or 12 day trip, and that he was going to leave that afternoon. About 9 o'clock, we got word that the departure was delayed until late that evening or early the next day. Perhaps that might have been a cue, but those of us in the office certainly didn't recognize it as such. At 10 o'clock, the vice president went over to the Blair House for a presentation ceremony, which he presented congressional medals of honor to seven families posthumously. And when he came back, there was a call for him to go to the White House and meet the president. And he left the office a little after 11 o'clock. Before he had left the office, the wires had the story that he was being invited to the office. And everyone, the phones then started to ring. And they didn't stop until 11 o'clock at night. As soon as he came back, things started happening in the office. In addition to the flood of phone calls, we got word that the trip to California was being canceled, and the word was passed that things would be happening, but we didn't know when. And then at 2 o'clock, the vice president called his staff, about 25 people, the so-called senior staff, including myself, in, and gave a little five-minute talk in which he thanked the staff for its long hours and hard work, and asked the staff to bear with him while the transition was being made, and said he hoped it would be, and thought it would be, smooth. There was no promise, however, that you will, that those in their present positions would continue in their present positions. And later that afternoon, Paul Milich and I got a considerable jolt when we were told by the vice president that Jerry Terhorst, the chief of the Washington Bureau for the Detroit Free Press, for the Detroit News, not the Free Press, was being taken on the staff on a temporary basis as liaison man to assist in the transition with the White House press office. Paul asked or said he didn't quite understand, and the vice president didn't make it any clearer than that. Dan Rather later came on CBS and said that Ter Horst would be the new press secretary. My guess is that's exactly what will happen. And what will happen to Paul and myself, we don't know. And this may be the end of the recollections. However, the vice president also discussed in some detail the plans he had for the swearing-in ceremony, which it turned out were considerably changed later on because of the number of guests that were being invited to the ceremony. Had originally been scheduled either for the Oval Office or for the Rose Garden, but when the number of guests became known, it was switched to the East Room, at least as of 11 o'clock tonight. That's where it will be held at noon tomorrow. The vice president also said he wanted to make a statement at the after the president made his resignation speech, and Paul had drafted a paragraph. Paul and I really had drafted the paragraph, and the vice president asked to see it, but when he made his appearance, he really hadn't used any of it, and spoke off the cuff, really. And outside of having answered conservatively at least 200 phone calls, if not more, personally during the day, my voice may sound a little gravelly tonight. That's why. Outside of that, we had about 10 minutes with the vice president. That was the only time we saw him all day. He had some dark circles under his eye. It looked as though he hadn't slept very much. But he also was very calm and very serious and very very intent on what he was doing. And whatever happens to me, I have great confidence in him, and I think he'll make a good president, simply because he does have confidence in himself, which is one of the great things that Richard Nixon lacked, and which I think a president needs above all. So we'll see what happens, and perhaps we'll continue this, and perhaps we may not. Just before I came home, I had a call from Sandy Sokolow, who's managing the pool for the networks concerning the ceremony, the swearing-in ceremony. He said that he'd had word from Ziegler that he should clear everything with Jerry Ter Horst, and I said, well, I'd gave him Jerry Ter Horst's office and home phone number, and Sokolow wanted to know some details about the ceremony. So I called Bob Hartman when I couldn't get hold of Ter Horst, and Hartman said the Michigan Mafia is taking over, and let them run it. So my feeling is that the appointment for Horst was Bill Seidman's appointment, and that Ter Horst indeed will be press secretary, and that Seidman obviously has growing influence with the vice president, and that Hartman is moving farther in the background. And what will happen from now on will be very interesting, and we'll see. It's a whole new ball game, and not at all the ball game that I figured it would be. So We shall see what happens tomorrow and then on. Well, I'm hoarse from answering so many telephone calls. It's now midnight of August 9th, the day that it all happened, and I hope I can get all on tape, at least as much of it that's significant. It all started out pretty calmly, as a matter of fact, and almost routinely. The vice president had a meeting with Secretary of State Kissinger shortly after he got in the office, about 8:15, and I had a tape to record that the vice president was to record for the participants in a new housing project that was being dedicated in Watts in Los Angeles. This was what he was supposed to visit on his California trip that had been canceled by the events of the previous day. And it was a very uncertain beginning for me, because I seriously at that time believed that it was my future was very uncertain. But nevertheless, went ahead with the routine, with sort of a facade of gaiety, I guess. I hope I had a good facade, but I was really considerably concerned and uncertain, let's put it that way. So I'd made a tentative agreement with the vice president the day before to record this thing at 9 o'clock, and we got it set up with the audiovisual people in the White House staff, and they brought up their recorder, and we're set up and ready to go at 9 o'clock. And I notified the vice president that it was time, and so he said, "Well, let's go to 9:15," which was cutting it pretty close, because he had to be over at the White House on the South Lawn before 10 o'clock to see the president off. The timing was the president would leave at 10, board the plane at 10, take off, and while he was in the air on the way to Los Angeles, San Clemente, the change in command would take place. The vice president came out a little late, about 9:30 it was, before he finally broke clear, and it allowed me several minutes in the office before he decided to come. While he was going through with Bob Hartman the last steps in the ceremony of the swearing-in and the reception, and it was as if he were discussing something very very normal, very routine. There was no real indication of serious pressure. Actually, Bob Hartman seemed a little more flustered and excited than the vice president did. And then he went in, he sat down at the table, he did his recording just as normally. He read through it first and then did it again, and he made a very small fluff during, not really a fluff, but just substituting an on for an and. So I asked him if he wanted to do it over. He said, "No, I'm sorry, I don't have time." And at 20 minutes of 10, he left the conference room and went on to watch the president take off and bid him goodbye. Also, at the time, I'd brought him in the final copy of his swearing-in speech. This was, he had no time to look at it before he went to see the vice president off, or see the president off, and had some time after he came back, about 11:15, had perhaps half an hour to go through it again. Really not much time for such an important speech. It read well, and I thought it would go well, but the event was so much more impressive than I had imagined it would be, that it was really a very moving experience. Until 10:30, I really didn't know whether I'd even be able to take part in the ceremony. It was very limited. But I forgot to tell you that I had great problems trying to find Jerry Terhorst, who didn't come in until 9 o'clock and then was closeted with Bill Seidman for half an hour, and we had great problems with the pool coverage and other coverage and Michigan press coming in, Michigan TV stations coming in, all wanting to do something. So I finally got all the Michigan people cleared for the White House press room, and just had them sit there. There's a place to wait and sort of grab what they could. They'd all claimed they'd been told they were going to get exclusive interviews with the vice president, and everybody who is quoted by them as saying they would get exclusive interviews denied it. But I have a feeling that they were promised exactly that, and that I was left, or the press office really was left, as the place that would be responsible for the problems they would encounter, which everyone knew they would encounter, because we were able to get them into the East Room for the ceremony, which helped out somewhat, but they didn't get their exclusive. Anyway, after taking care of all these problems, which is simply a matter of making a few phone calls, but getting 80 million phone calls in order to do it, I went over, was told I should get over to the White House press office right away. This was about 10:30, 10:45. And so I went over, and the first thing that I was told was by Tom DeCare, who is Jerry Warren's assistant, sort of a deputy press secretary, that his office was now my office, and he'd moved out everything. It was a bare office, and he said, "That's your office." And I said, "Are you sure?" And he said, "Oh, yes." And that was really the first solid indication that I'd had that I might be kept on. And so, of course, that buoyed my spirits considerably. So then I suggested that I go over and check out the TV pool situation and the other cameras, and they said okay. So I went over, and there were a few little problems, but they were mainly ones of technical detail, which are the ones that I learn are the real problems. In other words, what's the seating order of the Ford family? Where are the VIPs situated? Who are they? Can we get idents? And where exactly is the vice president going to come in? Where will he leave? And so forth. One of the most interesting things, though, and most illustrative, I think, of the man, I happened to be standing by one of his military aides, Colonel Jack Walker, while he was discussing with the captain of the Marine Band the ceremonial music that would be involved. And the captain said, "Well, we're going to play our four ruffles and flourishes as the vice president comes in, and then the hail to the chief as he comes out." And Colonel Walker said, "I don't think that's on the schedule." And the captain said, "Oh, yes." And Colonel Walker said, "Let me check." And he went back to the telephone, called the executive office building, and came back in 1 minute. He said, "No ruffles and flourishes, no hail to the chief." And that's the way it was. It was a simple announcement, the vice president of the United States and Mrs. Ford, when they came in. And absolutely no ruffles and flourishes, and no ruffles and flourishes when he left. And it's a mark of the man and of his ideas and of his distaste for the glamour and the trappings of the office that so seemed to grip Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson. and perhaps even President Kennedy. Harry Truman and Gerald R. Ford have a great deal in common in their approach to life and to the presidency. It'll be very interesting to see how Gerald R. Ford conveys to the people his simplicity and his ideas of the simple values which Harry Truman also had and so successfully expressed. Well, that's a divergence, but I think it's really a very significant factor, very significant, and to me most important. Well, so while I was occupied with all the details, the ceremonies began, and I managed to stand in a place very close to the platform and was able to, from where I stood, to watch the crowd. All I could see was the back of the vice president's head while he was speaking. But when he got to the part where his voice broke, as he said, I want to ask you to offer a prayer for Richard Nixon and his family, I could see tears on the faces of a number of people there, and some of those were hardened politicians who've been in the business a long time, and it was a most moving moment. And after it was over, the applause was so sincere and so prolonged, it indicated to me that he really had done exactly what we had hoped he would do to set out the kind of a man he is, and a man without pretension, without glamour, but with great sincerity. So when it was over and they had a reception, I went back to the White House press office, and we had 83 million phone calls, of course. And at about 2 o'clock, I think it was, or so, excuse me, the president, almost said vice president, the president came in to introduce Jerry Terhorst, his new press secretary, and did, as his new press secretary, and did it very gracefully with a little joke about how they were standing on ground, the press was standing on the part of the White House that he would like most, the swimming pool, which had been converted in the press office, and he joked that he might reconvert it. And but in the process of introducing Terhorst, he also said that joining Jerry on the press team would be his press people from his vice presidential staff, Paul Milich and Bill Roberts, and that was the real confirmation that I had that I was going to be kept on. And I felt a great load of relief lifted from my shoulders. So I went on from there with much greater spirit, much happier spirit anyway. And the day, I don't know whether I can, let me stop to think here. It really is sort of a blur. I don't remember many specifics. One thing that I do remember is the tremendous speed of the White House photographic operation in getting out pictures. The ceremony took place at noon. By 5 o'clock, we had, and then there were some formal pictures taken in the Oval Office of the Vice President, the President, Mrs. Ford, and the entire Ford family, plus the regular shots of the ceremony that the White House photographers had taken. And by 5 o'clock, we had color prints, just unbelievable to me, of all that, and enough to distribute to the press, and very good color, very good color. The speed of that operation is just a matter of great amazement to me, because I know a little about photography and what it takes. Another thing that impressed me was on the way over to the White House about 10:30, quarter of 11, as I walked across the Executive Avenue, you go in through the west door of the west wing of the White House, and then you walk through a long, narrow hall that goes through the ground level and up one flight to the press office. And all the way along that long hall, which is just a plain hall broken only by doorways, are photographs. And these had been photographs of Richard Nixon in various activities and the Nixon family. As I was going through at quarter of 11, the Nixon photographs were being taken down, and the Gerald R. Ford photographs, very similar, but ones they'd taken mostly of him as vice president. In fact, all of them as vice president. There may be some as minority leader, but they'd had it from somewhere else. But they're almost all vice presidential pictures. They were going up. And by 12 o'clock, all the Nixon photographs had been replaced, except in the press room. But anyway, the ones that were controlled by the White House Photographic Service, all those were replaced. Just unbelievable. It reminded me of the assassination of President Kennedy when, by the time Kennedy's body was brought back from Dallas, everything of his in the Oval Office and in the White House always, you know, had been removed, and Lyndon Johnson's things had been brought in. Same thing had happened in the Oval Office, of course, but with only 2 hours to work in. Fantastic. There was also an interesting... I didn't have time, I was on the phone too much, to see much of President Nixon's farewell. What I saw was very moving to me, although Tom DeCare, who was one of his press secretaries, thought it was maudlin. But I was moved, felt a deep sadness as the president nearly wept, and obviously understandably, it was intensely emotional in bidding farewell to his staff. And then the departure scene, of course, was even more so. But the contrast between that and the new president in delivering his swearing-in speech was, again, an indication of the differences in the two men. A great indication. So where was I? I'm afraid I'm wandering. The afternoon. We were spent the afternoon after the press briefing. I learned I have a new task, which is to proofread the transcripts of the press briefing, which is a job because they, of course, are taken by ear, and there are a lot of mistakes in them where the reporter hears words that sound similar, and so you have to be pretty alert to the meaning of what's being said as well as the physical. I'm a good proofreader in detecting errors in spelling, but not very good in detecting errors in meaning, because I tend to read words instead of meaning, look at words for spelling rather than. So I'm going to have to learn a new technique for this type of proofreading. But that, you know, all this takes time. You get phone calls and all that sort of thing. I wish I had kept track of how many phone calls I had and how many I answered that day, because by the time we quit, My voice was, still is, a little husky, and even my ear was tired. But I've had a half or a quarter of beer, and I feel much better now. We were told to be in the office by before 7:30 tomorrow morning, because the president, I have problems with it. The president would be in very early, and you know, now that I think of it, it still seems not quite real to me that they're really...